Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 14. Sandbutton Revisited and Afterwards. Early in 1866, when Patterson deserted Mary in Lynn, Abigail made one last effort to solve the problem which her sister presented, and to solve it in the way she desired. She wrote Mary a letter in which she promised to do anything and everything for her on one condition, namely, that she should give up her queer ideas and return to the orthodox religious views of her family. Abigail was a typical New Englander of her period, wherein nothing was dreaded so much as queerness. And queerness was, of course, appraised on the universal basis of numbers. Spiritualism, at that time, had long ceased to be queer. It had too many adherents. In any event, it claimed to be no more than an adjunct to orthodox faith. And some of the best people quite unfearfully admitted an interest in it. If Mary had professed a devotion to spiritualism, the probabilities are that Abigail, far from being embarrassed by it, would have felt nothing but approval, even though she could not follow along with her. But this strange new teaching to which her sister was devoting herself so earnestly, with its outlandish claims of spiritual healing, moral regeneration, and what not, was queer in the fullest sense of the word. No wonder people like the Phillipses and the Olivers and the Winslows of Lynn had been trying to dissuade Mary from having anything to do with it. That this, or something very like it, was Abigail's line of reasoning is clear from her letter, in which she offers to build her sister a house right next door, in which she can live her own life unmolested and pursue her writing undisturbed. But there is a string attached to this tempting offer. There is only one thing I ask of you, Mary, that you give up these ideas which have lately occupied you, that you attend our church and give over your theory of divine healing. In all the years that Mary had been suffering from sickness and want and loneliness, Abigail had never offered to do so much. True, she had helped her again and again, but her aid was always characterized by a sound New England caution, which is quite absent from this offer. It is hard to say to what extent it constituted any temptation to Mary. Her reply to Abigail's letter has not been preserved, but the facts speak sufficiently for themselves. Mary did not accept the offer, and shortly afterwards, as has been seen, left Lynn to join the Crafts at Stoughton. But Mary Patterson loved Sandbutton. Like Bow and Concord, it was essential New Hampshire. In all her long life, the hills and valleys of her native state, its ruggedness and grandeur, had place in her heart, which only became more simple and more secure as the years went by. And so, in the summer of 1867, when everything seemed to be moving well with her and the Crafts in their new home at Taunton, with Hiram Crafts well established in his office and apparently on the way to success, Mary's thoughts turned towards Sandbutton. She had not been there since her brief visit in 1861, when she stopped with Abigail for a few days on her way from the misery of Rumney to the still greater misery of Dr. Vail's sanatorium at Hill. And then she was too ill to care much about anything. But now her health was better. From now on, sickness enters steadily less and less into the record of her life. And she is eager to see Sandbutton and her friends and family once again. So much may perhaps be justly inferred from the simple course of things. But in any event, the August of 1867 found her in Sandbutton staying with her sister Martha. Time had wrought many changes. Martha, it will be remembered, had married Luther Pillsbury, a young lawyer of Concord. And now Luther was dead, and Martha had come back to Sandbutton with her daughter Ellen, a girl of 21, to make her home there. Mark Baker had been gone a year or more, and in the big house off the main street, which Mark had built for himself next to the Tiltons, Mary's brother George, the much-loved Sullivan of her earliest letters, lay dying. It was, in many ways, a sad homecoming. George, who had long managed a branch of the Tilton Mills at Baltimore, had been struggling against failing sight for several years. It preyed upon him, sadly, until at last, totally blind and broken in mind and body, he returned to his old home at Sandbutton to die. Next door was Abigail, now far and away the first lady of the first family in Sandbutton. Hamilton Tilton had prospered greatly, and Abigail was, more and more, developing that remarkable ability, which, on her husband's death some 10 years later, enabled her to take entire charge of his business and build up a fortune which, at the time of her death, was one of the most considerable in the state. The local records show that in 1882, when Abigail took over the business, the mill property embraced 75 acres, extended a third of a mile down the river, and controlled an immense water power. There were 32 looms and 1,700 spindles. The mill employed 75 hands and had a monthly product in tweeds and meltons of 30,000 yards. Abigail was a great lady, and she was so in much more than a merely ironic sense. She was so often right in business that she had come to expect, as a matter of course, that obedience which real ability so often secures. Her mistake was the common one of expecting a similar obedience in other fields. Mary's determination to think for herself had always irritated her, and this, her latest exhibition of free thinking, seemed to Abigail the last straw. As Mrs. Eddy put it many years afterwards in an article replying to one of her critics, "My oldest sister dearly loved me, but I wounded her pride when I adopted Christian Science, and to a baker that was a sorry offense." There is no record of Mary's meeting with Abigail on this occasion, but from a pathetic little poem found among her papers and written about this time, it might reasonably be inferred that she saw Abigail and saw her often, that Abigail strove with a high hand to have her way, and when she failed, determined that the breach between them should be final, and told Mary so. But before the final break took place, Mary had done other things to cause Abigail offense. She had done the worst thing she could do. She had put her queer ideas into practice, almost in Abigail's presence. And perhaps most unforgivable of all, had been successful. It was towards the end of Mary's stay that it happened. Ellen Pillsbury, her sister Martha's daughter, developed an abscess which failed to yield to ordinary methods of treatment, until the girl became seriously ill. Mary was eager to help, but hesitated. On this point, the whole family was as one against her. There is some evidence that she had tried to induce George to allow her to help him, but had been rebuffed. Ellen, however, was not so prejudiced. Mary was to find this true of young people frequently in the future. And when her aunt with the queer views asked the girl if she might help her, she readily assented. Mary appears to have gone into her niece's room just before the family sat down to supper, for it was while they were still sitting around the table that the door opened and she and Ellen entered together. There was silence for a moment as the little company looked from one to another in amazement. And then, before anyone could speak, Ellen told them calmly that she was quite well and wanted to sit down and have supper with them. There was instant protest from everyone present. To them, it was the most dangerous bravado. But Ellen was determined, and in an atmosphere which changed kaleidoscopically from resentment to acquiescence, and thence to sullen surrender, she made a good supper, using her hand as before, with no trace of the trouble. Next day found her completely recovered. As subsequent events proved, far from being impressed by this exhibition of a power they did not understand, the family was more outraged than ever. Ellen, however, was, for the time being, completely won over, and when Mary, realizing that no spark of welcome remained for her anywhere, determined to return to Taunton, Ellen insisted on going with her. And so they set out together. There is no picture of the leave-taking of Mary with her family as she left Sandbunton for the last time. It is, however, a fact that friendly relations were never restored, and that not even letters ever again passed between her and her sisters. I loved Mary best of all my sisters and brothers, Abigail was wont to say, but it is all gone now. It must have been with strangely mixed feelings that Mary made the long journey, over 100 miles by stage and train, from Sandbutton to Taunton. She was estranged, finally, from her family, and she had parted from Abigail in such a way as to make it certain that she could never ask her aid or counsel again. But there were compensations. Her niece Ellen was apparently devoted to her, and Mary can hardly have failed to hope that this love might prove a healing link between her and her people. Then, too, she was going back to her work at Taunton. Hiram Crafts, as far as she knew, was still doing well, and no one could tell what Ellen might not do. This dream of better things was destined to be rudely shattered soon after she got back to Taunton. For instead of the serenity and promise which was all around when she left, she came back to find Mrs. Crafts dead set against the renewed monopolizing of her husband by this Mrs. Patterson's all-absorbing teaching. And Hiram Crafts, a man more than half inclined to see the matter through his wife's eyes, and agree that he could get on as well without Mrs. Patterson as with her, perhaps better. Neither was that all, for within a few days, in a sudden revulsion of feeling, Ellen rounded upon her, insisting that her mother and Aunt Abigail were right about her and her queer ideas and common associates, and that she was going back to Sandbutton. And so Ellen went. A few days afterwards, on August 13th, 1867, Mary sat down and wrote the little poem already alluded to, which some 40 years later was found among her papers. It is called Alone. I've sought the home my childhood gave, a moment's shelter from the wave. Then those, when sick, whose pain I bore, a sister drove me from the door. O weary heart, O tired sigh, so wronged to live, alone I'd die. There are 5 stanzas in all. The first 3 are occupied with these thoughts of her aloneness and with frailty of all human ties. As always with Mary, it is not great poetry, but in the last 2 stanzas, wherein she rises to a sense of joy in contemplating the compensations of the spiritual vision, the woman attains to those simple devotional heights which were to make her one of the most effective hymn writers of her time. To bless mankind with word and deed, thy life a great and noble creed. O glorious hope, my faith renew. O mortal joys, adieu, adieu. Mary set out once again in search of a resting place. Her writing occupied her time and thought more and more. And her first desire, when she left the Crafts at Taunton, would naturally be to find some place where she could pursue her purpose in this direction in peace and quiet. But she did not know where to turn, and so she went back to Lynn and sought the advice of her old friends, the Winslows. It was the Winslows, it will be remembered, who, in spite of the fact that Mrs. Winslow, through Mary's ministrations, had been released from a wheelchair in which she had spent the previous 16 years, had earnestly begged her not to pursue her studies further, and above all, not to talk about them to anyone. Mr. Winslow was a retired Unitarian minister, and the position of Unitarianism at that time is perhaps sufficient explanation of his fundamental disquiet over anything savoring so strongly of mysticism as he conceived Mary's healings to do. Unitarianism in America had recently gone through deep waters in this direction, and it was only a few years previously that the National Unitarian Conference, viewing with grave concern a wayward tendency in their body towards German idealism, rationalism, and mysticism, had adopted a definitely Christian platform, affirming that its members were disciples of the Lord Jesus Christ. The fact, however, that a large minority had refused any such acknowledgement and had gone out and formed the Free Religious Association could only render the Orthodox Unitarian more distrustful than ever of anything so unorthodox as spiritual healing. The Winslows seem, however, to have been sincerely devoted to Mary, and when she explained to them, as she must have done, that all she wanted was quiet to think and write, they bethought them of a friend they had in Amesbury, a little town some 40 miles to the north, near the New Hampshire border, who might take her in and give her what she needed. Amesbury was an ideal place for the purpose. It was the home of the poet Whittier, who was then at the height of his career. And while Whittier was a Quaker and a rebel in many respects, the Winslows evidently had no doubt as to his fundamental orthodoxy. And so Mary set out. It was late fall, and it was evening when she arrived in Amesbury. In all probability, she carried with her a letter of introduction to Mrs. Mary Esther Carter, the friend of the Winslows already mentioned. At any rate, this was her first house of call. Mrs. Carter, as it turned out, could not take her in, but advised her to go down the street to the home of Mrs. Nathaniel Webster, who had a large house and was always glad to welcome strangers. So Mary set out once more. It must have been quite dark by this time, but as she made her way down Merrimack Street towards the river, it would not be long before the lights of Mrs. Webster's big 3-story house could be seen through the trees. There could be no mistaking it. Mrs. Carter had told her that it comprised 15 rooms at least. And in a moment or two, Mary had passed through the gate in the picket fence, under the 2 giant elms on each side of the porch, and was knocking at the big front door. It was opened by Mrs. Nathaniel Webster herself, a large woman with a broad, kindly face, clearly justifying her reputation for hospitality. And to her, in the dim light, Mary told her story. She must have been very tired, but she evidently wanted Mrs. Webster to know the facts, and when she had finished, she added simply that she knew she had been led to come to her. Mother Webster had apparently no doubt about it, and standing aside to let Mary enter, she exclaimed, "Glory to God, come right in."